Is it possible to get lost in time? Well, come to Kamchatka and see for yourself. Here, several unique ethnic groups are remaining in their own bubble of sorts, surrounded by these beautiful landscapes. We've come to see how the natives of Russia's far, far east live and preserve their ancient traditions and culture. And if we've come this far, we know that it's going to be worth the journey. So one thing that I've come to learn here in Kamchatka is it really is a true melting pot, many different cultures coming together. But the Edelmen were believed to be the first people to come to Kamchatka. You yourself are Edelmen. Where do you come from?
We don't know from where the Edelmen came to Kamchatka. There are several theories, but none have been proven. One hypothesis says the Edelmen sailed here from Hawaii. Another claims we trekked from Mongolia. Some say we originate in America. However, the Edelmen call themselves the people living here. That's what Edelmen literally means, a local. Archaeologists proved that the Edelmen have been living here for over 8,000 years. They were here before the Koryaks, the Chukchi, the Evens, and the Aleuts. Our ancestors had spread across these parts before their arrival. They worked the land, they fished, hunted sea mammals, gathered, did woodwork and grasswork, etc. And we, their descendants, continue those traditions.
So the German scientist, George Steller, he was also a traveler. He has a theory that, and you've already touched on this a little bit, that the Edelmen and the North American natives are the same people. Now, you've been to Canada, you've been to North America, in the States. What's your thought?
We're often told that we look like the Tlingit, the Cherokee, etc. But I see differences, and they see them too. Our languages are different, and so are our cultures. Dance, for example. Our traditional activities are not the same either. Sure, there's a similarity. When you visit one of their villages, you look like you could easily blend in. But the clothes are different, traditions and culture. So I think we're different from them in that we're indigenous to Kamchatka. They have their own tribes and ethnicities with their own rich cultures and traditions.
You mentioned earlier that the Edelmen are believed to have come here to Kamchatka 8,000 years ago. In that 8,000 years, are there still traditions from then that you still have in your daily life and your daily routine?
Yes, we do have these traditions. We still celebrate the Edelmen ritual festival of Al-Halalalai. Like our ancestors, we chase evil spirits away. All our women get together, make awful faces, and scream their heads off until evil spirits, the Kana, leave our homes and our families. We still dance till we drop. We still love to have fun, sing chodilas, and dance like our ancestors did. Boredom was a major sin for them. Having fun, enjoying life, feeling happy is one of the most important pursuits for the Edelmen. And we still respect this tradition of ours. We still weave grass baskets using seaweed. Towards the end of August, we go to the Pacific shore to gather seaweed. We use it to cover our typical Edelmen dwellings, pit houses, and balagans. And then there's fish, of course. Fish is our livelihood. We still fish, dry fish roe, we dry yukula, a fish meat that comes from sockeye salmon, chum salmon, and coho salmon. We make a lot of preserves for ourselves and for our dogs. We pick berries. For us, if you don't go foraging, then it's like you haven't lived that year. As soon as berries come out, you feel this urge within you. You want to go and pick them. them. And I'm not talking about picking raspberries and strawberries in the garden. I'm talking about cranberries, blue honeysuckle, and crowberries. In a sense, we, modern Itelmen, still follow the traditional lifestyle of our forefathers. We talk to the earth spirits, negotiate with them, and thank them during specific parts of the year, exactly when our ancestors did the same.
One of the traditions that you have and the abilities that you have, I would say, is being able to cook using wooden pots without an open fire. For me, that just seems impossible. How do you do that?
Our ancestors didn't use iron. This is a steel knife. But in the past, tools would be made of obsidian or stone. These days, we cook like everyone else, and it's the women who do it. In ancient times, however, men were in charge of the cooking. They would heat stones in a fire and put them inside wooden pots with water and pieces of fish. By replacing cool stones with hot ones from the fire, they would simmer the fish soup. It's really delicious. Our traditional ancient way of cooking is much better at preserving all the wholesome properties of fish. They didn't use salt. I'd suggest you give it a try. It's a physically challenging process, though. Hats off to them. You get hot standing next to a fire. They would strip to the waist and sometimes even remove their pants. Cooking would be done inside a pit house. They had special wooden tools to help them pull stones from the fire, drop them inside the pots, and put them back.
I want to ask about the raven. I know that it's very important to the Itelmen culture, but it's also important in Ireland. The Irish goddess of war, Morgana, is also surrounded by ravens. She appears as a raven. The Scandinavian god Odin also is surrounded by ravens. Why do you think that this icon of the raven is so important to the Itelmen and across many different indigenous cultures?
The Koryaks and the Chukchi also believe that Kutkinyaku, the raven, created Kamchatka and gave birth to the Koryak and the Chukchi people. The Itelmen believe that the Kutch, the raven, together with his wife Ilhum, created the land of Kamchatka. We see this differently from the Koryaks and the Chukchi, for whom this land was a rock lifted from the depths of the ocean. For us, this land is a living thing. Once upon a time, the Kutch and Ilhum were flying over these parts, and all they could see was an expanse of water. They landed, and the raven was able to stand, but his wife sank to her chest. And there she gave birth to their son, Simskalin, which means earthen. And Kutch the raven made him become land, which means we walk upon the land of Kutch and Ilhum's first son, Simskalin. When we call to the spirit of the earth, it's Simskalin we talk to. We say, Simskalin, thank you, please help us. Later they had more children, and at some point, the Itelmen came into existence. Is it a coincidence that many consider the raven to be their forefather, a wise bird, or some kind of an important character in our story? I don't know. What I know is that the raven holds a lot of symbolism for Russians as well. It symbolizes wisdom, a sort of intellectual force that sees everything. It's a hard question to answer, but I like the fact that we share some characters, be that metaphorical representations or actual spirits we believe in. They unify us. It means humanity used to be one. It just means tribes split apart at some point and went their separate ways. The raven, however, remains that link which still binds us together. I'm sure that, at some level, our cultures have something in common, the way we see ourselves and perceive our connection to nature.
It's my understanding, and we've talked about this a little bit already in this conversation, that dance is very important to the Itelmen culture. But in the past, dance was asking for a good hunt or maybe asking for good health. Does dance today have the same type of meaning for you, or is it more just tradition?
No, our dances are also rituals. You enter a sort of trance. During the Itelman Festival of Al-Halalalai, we hold the Russian Traditional Dance Championship for the indigenous people of Kamchatka, where we dance for 17 hours nonstop. There, we share energy, communicate with our tribes, the earth, and the spirits. It's an unforgettable experience. Each indigenous dance is a story, a way to get in touch with higher powers and the energy that surrounds us. Air, water, earth, fire, and the spirits of animals, which we sometimes also invoke in our dance. Many years ago, the Itelmen used to dance till they literally dropped from exhaustion.
Over generations and generations, different ethnic groups within Kamchatka have mixed. Is it safe to say that the cultures and traditions of the different groups have mixed to become a unique Kamchatka culture?
Certainly. Traditions and cultures are mixed. Traditionally, Koryak men and women never dance close to each other. They dance their separate dances, each in their own bubble. The Itelmen are very different. I see a man Ihilke, the Ihilke sees a woman Mimsk, and we go, The Koryaks have adopted this dance practice. Now they too can dance together and have fun. There's a cross-pollination of cultures. On the one hand, it's beautiful. On the other, it's becoming more difficult to make distinctions and figure out what authentic Itelmen culture is. There are no more pure Itelmen. Itelmen families are all mixed with other ethnic groups.
First of all, I want to thank you for bringing us in here to have this look into your life, into your culture. It's fascinating. Thank you. I guess I want to ask first, what does it mean to be Koryak? Where do the Koryak people come from? And what does it mean to you?
There's a distinction. There are coastal Koryaks, the Nimlan, and tundra Koryaks, the Chavchuvan, who herd reindeer. They're known as rich folks because they have huge herds and reindeer are highly prized. Our grandmas, who raised and taught us in the village, would always say that the Koryaks' main treasure were a large family, a really large one, and a herd of deer. That's why people took good care of their families and their reindeer. The reindeer maybe even took priority, as they were essential to life. All our clothes, everything we have, everything our ancestors had, it all revolved around reindeer. When they made clothes or ate reindeer meat, they used to say that the animals lived on with them. We wear its skin. Life goes on.
You can see that we're surrounded by reindeer hides, and I can see that they're working specifically on making these beautiful clothes that you're known for. It seems to me that it would be incredibly difficult to make all of these clothes by hand. Do you have specific tools that you use to make your clothes?
Yes, we do. Before civilization came to us, so to speak, there were these old tools. These are the tips. They were created naturally. Take a look, they're very old. This rock is used to curry leather. This is the best traditional tool. Here's a more modern version from the time when we began using iron. Which is sharper than stone. When my grandma had me tan a hide with this iron tool, she didn't give me a high-quality piece because she knew I would rip it. So she gave me anything that wasn't valuable. We used to use this board for tanning. We place it like this and put the deer skin on top of it. I'm not going to press hard now, because this piece has already been tanned. Otherwise, I would be going like this. Your arms get really tired, but that's how you build muscles and become very strong. We remove the top layer. We grease the hide with deer muck several times, three or four, so it becomes soft. When it's soft like this, we can further process it using our hands.
How much time does it take for you to make a specific piece of clothing? Let's say a kuhlyanka or a fur coat, for example.
Regarding how long it takes, it depends on what the craft artist's plan is, how detailed and beautiful she wants this piece of clothing to be. Mm-hmm. There is also burial clothing. It is our custom to have that ready when people are still alive. Today it would be very unusual, but our people had this tradition. We made our own burial clothes. It would take three or four similar pieces to make a complete set for a woman my size. Touch and feel how soft it is.
Very cool. Now I understand that you decorate so beautifully your clothing with bands and symbols. Are they just decorative or do they have meaning?
I'll show you a piece so you can compare. These ornaments are called suns today. We call them yagulgu in Karak, meaning moons. Karaks still use the lunar calendar for seasons based on the lunar phases. The Karak people know how to get their bearings using the moon and stars. Our ancestors were really good at finding their way like this. You know, beads were brought here in exchange for local products. We didn't have beads before that. And local craftswomen took a liking to them once because they added beauty to the traditional needlework patterns and brought out their authenticity. I'm talking about the traditional moons our ancestors used to embroider on their clothes without beads. They made beads of their own from natural materials, like fish bones, shells, and deer hair. Here, I'll show you. This is an authentic Karak sun pattern, or a moon, as we call it.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what the symbols and bands mean specifically?
The Karaks displayed their lifestyle in these decorations. And the most important thing for them was the deer. So most often depict deer antlers or mountains, volcanoes or tree branches. Coastal Karaks, also called Nimlans, lived along the coast, so they had these wave patterns. As for the colors they used, there weren't as many color options as today. They mostly used red, black, and white in their ornaments. My grandma used to say, when we decorated my fur jacket, kuhlyanka, that you need to take inspiration from the ground. Black or brown represents earth. Green is for grass. But we didn't have green or light blue, for example. The choice of colors was limited to the basics, black, red, and white. White is the color of sanctity, purity. Red is the color of defense. It gives protection. That's it. Back in those days, our craftswomen also made carpets, which told their family stories. There was no writing system, so ornaments told stories. You could tell from those pictures the family's occupation. Even tragic incidents were depicted, when someone died or was killed away from home. family history was passed down in ornaments.
There's a legend about a nomad who roamed the earth with his reindeer. When the animal grew old and weary, it turned to his master and said, "Kill me, drink my blood, and we will become one. My soul will come back to earth and give birth to a new race of reindeer people." We are now headed across the tundra of Kamchatka to meet the descendants of those very people, the Evans.
So you're out here with no signs, in the middle of nowhere, no communication. How do you know where to go?
We have our special routes. We can't go beyond certain limits because that's outside our pasture. So we pay for the right to keep our animals in certain areas and for hunting land. There are climate factors too. It's very hard to dig if there's a lot of snow. The deer can't get to the moss, so we need to move to another place with less snow, up to 50 centimeters.
How many reindeer do you have in your herd here, and is it difficult to control them?
2,000, including the calves. The number fluctuates as some deer become sick or fall prey to other animals, including two-legged ones. People are predators too. It's not easy to control a reindeer. It depends on the pasture land. If you stay in the same place all the time, you'll destroy all the moss. It takes up to 25 years for new moss to grow. You need at least 15 years for some moss to appear. So we can't stay in the same spot. We need to keep the reindeer moving, looking for areas where there isn't a lot of snow or ice.
When you're out here in the nature, when you're with the reindeer, what do you feel? What is in it for you?
I feel free out here. I'm not bothered by wars or anything else. Civilization doesn't get in the way. There's no radio, though, so I can't listen to the news. Of course, I'll find things out later, but just the gist. But I don't ask for anything else.
Круто. Спасибо.
Dog sledding has a very special place in the life of the indigenous people in Kamchatka. What seems like entertainment for some was once a crucial method of survival in extreme weather. The Samajkin family is now reviving these ancient traditions.
Now that is impressive. Andrei, hi. Let's get right to it. I've heard the rumors that your children, before they can even walk, are already in a sled. What is sledding to you with these dogs? Is it a sport? Is it a way of life? Is it an ancient tradition? Talk to me about that.
It's true what they say. My wife participates in dog sled races, even when she's pregnant. And of course, our kids are in the sled with her. Sledding for us is our life, a life in the forest with dogs, close to nature. It's how we pass our culture, tradition, and emotions down to our children. They're very perceptive. They grow up surrounded by this, strong, healthy, and learning from us. Later, they do dog sledding on their own.
And I can tell your whole family is involved. So, what exactly is a musher, and what do you have to have in your skill set to become one?
The musher, or kayur, is dedicated to his dogs. He lives with them. The musher drives the dog sled team. I would call him the boss, the leader. Everything depends on the musher, the entire life of his team. How do you become a musher? People usually start with one dog, and then the team starts growing with a second, a third.
Now, do you do anything special to train your dogs to run, or is this just in their genes?
When we're prepping for a race, it's like any athlete. We draft a plan and try to stick to it. But I believe these particular dogs have it in their blood. We don't need to make extra efforts to prep a dog for sledding. You just put it into the harness, hook it up to the sled, and off it goes.
I noticed an interesting phenomenon when they were getting ready to be hooked up. The entire group of them all started howling at once. What does this mean? Is this a rally cry that they're getting ready to go running?
It's a very interesting question, and I don't remember anyone giving a comprehensive answer to it. I think by howling, they express their unity and eagerness to run. Take wolves, for example. Once a wolf starts howling, the whole pack copies in solidarity. The same is happening here with the dogs. It's the manifestation of team spirit.
Now, this might seem like the most basic of questions, but how many dogs are there to a sled? Is there a limit, or is there a set number that have to be there?
We use between 6 and 16 dogs for one sled, depending on what's required from a particular run. If it's a long distance, 1,500 to 2,000 kilometers, we would use as many dogs as we can, up to 16. If it's a shorter run, 6, 8, or 10 dogs are plenty.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that different dogs have different roles on the sled, which implies the fact that they might have different psychological traits as well. How do you choose which specific dogs go where on a sled?
That's what we see right from the start, when the dogs are still puppies. They're kept in a kennel, and as they grow older, we start walking them. We take the mother on a leash and go to the forest for a walk. Then we can watch the pups and see their characters right away. Some pups are active and not afraid to run ahead. We mark them as potential lead dogs who will steer the team. Other pups are less active and always stay behind the braver ones. They will go in the middle of the dog team. And some always stay close to you, going round your legs. They won't run away. They are afraid to follow the rest of the team. These dogs will be harnessed in the rear of the team, directly in front of the sled, the wheel dogs. That's how dog roles are determined at an initial stage. Later, when you start training the dogs, their abilities will manifest themselves better.
Is there ever a case where there's a dog that just isn't suited for running, and what happens to that dog?
It happens. Sometimes a dog is afraid to run in the harness with the team. It starts to slow down or can even lie down. You can't use dogs like this again. They are usually very good companions for walks in the forest because they never run away. We have many such dogs here. They remain part of the family and stay here with the rest of the team.
We've traveled the breadth of the Kamchatka Peninsula, taking in its mesmerizing landscapes and people. They live in some of the harshest conditions known to man, through wind and snow, even making their homes amidst fire-breathing volcanoes. Yet here, there's total harmony between nature and people, preserving a unique culture and identity.